G'day humans, welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Do you ever have a conversation where you realise that the person you're talking to is really just not quite understanding where you're coming from and vice versa? It can be increasingly difficult to have conversations, especially about sensitive issues in these toxic and divisive times. Today's guest is an expert on that. His new book is called Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. Charles Duhigg is an American journalist and nonfiction author. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, you know, that little nod for the work that he did at the New York Times. And his previous book was also fascinating. We get into that a little bit as well. It's called The Power of Habit. He's sort of a world authority on the psychology of how we form habits, how we break habits, how they can be constructive, how they can be destructive. And the focus of his latest book is what great communicators have in common and how you can improve your own communication as well. Please enjoy, as much as I did, the one and only Charles Duhigg. But while we're talking about Substack, so are you on Substack or do you know those guys?
I am. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I have a newsletter on Substack.
That newsletter is a Substack thing, is it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I just started it about 6 months ago. So I'm not really like a pro the way that some people
Yeah.
are, but,
well,
but I like it. I like doing
I
it.
I know. It's fabulous. I mean, there's so much potential and I've got buddies who are making a fortune from it. So who knows?
Yeah, and exactly. And I am a big, anything that helps writers support themselves, I'm a huge fan.
Yes.
Of.
I mean, the fact that it is now actually possible. I hosted a talkback radio show in Sydney for the past 2 years and was able to leave at the end of last year and just do this. Largely, you know, because half of the revenue comes from Substack and about half from ads.
So you already have a big Substack.
Big enough. Yeah. Yeah. So
can I ask, like, how many, I'm just wondering, like, at what point it becomes, like how many subscribers and
That's
paid subscribers?
That's a very good question that my producer would know the answer to, which I don't. I just count the money, Charles. I mean, I don't know. I'm still at the early stages. I've only been on there for like 6 months, but it seems to be – this podcast has a lot of listeners, so you don't need a huge conversion rate for a large listener base to then go, yeah. Oh, we'll get the extra stuff as well because I do some bonus stuff on Substack that you can only get pay a monthly fee. So yeah, like who wants a job these days? Why do you need a job?
It's true.
It's great.
It's true. Knock on wood that it remains.
Yeah,
true.
Exactly. Exactly. So thanks for being here. I loved The Power of Habit when I first read it many years ago.
Oh, thank you.
And the new book is particularly interesting because this is sort of my life, having difficult conversations, you might call them uncomfortable conversations about things that people usually tiptoe around. One of the most interesting passages of the book is towards the end when you start talking about Netflix and the flare up at Netflix and what that tells us about how people communicate. So before we go big, can we go small and can you tell us what happened at Netflix?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really interesting story because, you know, obviously America has been living through this racial reckoning and I think it's around the world, right? Yeah. I think that you guys are experiencing it in New Zealand and in Australia and in the Commonwealth. And what happened at Netflix is that there was a senior executive who was in a meeting and he used the N-word. And this is obviously completely inappropriate.
Just
right?
to be it, a it linguistic just, pedant, he mentioned the N-word. Linguists would say there's a difference between mentioning a word and using the word in the sense that the usage would imply that he was addressing someone that way or he was deploying
the word.
Yeah, so
I guess he mentioned, right. Yeah, so he mentioned the word. He didn't call anyone the N-word. He was using it to try and illustrate he was using it to illustrate how offensive a new show was. But of course, there were people in the room who walked away saying, oh my God, this is completely inappropriate. And he ended up getting fired. But what it did is it set off this kind of civil war within Netflix because there had been a lot of people who felt like Netflix had a problem with race, that there was unconscious bias and that particularly African-Americans were not getting promoted as quickly. And then there were a bunch of other people who thought that that's not true at all. Like we're not racists. And actually the reason you're not succeeding here is not because of the color of your skin. It's because you don't have what you need to succeed. And as you can imagine, this just became incredibly contentious. So contentious that it started distracting from the work. It started destroying the culture. It was so bad that Reed Hastings, the CEO of the company, had a meeting with his top lieutenants and said, look, if we don't figure out how to stop this, how to lower the heat, I think it might end Netflix. Now, what would have been totally normal in a situation like that is for the executives to basically kind of stomp down and say, look, we're not going to have this conversation, right? Or we're going to have this conversation, but it's going to be very tightly controlled, to say, look, leave your politics at home, or there's some things that are appropriate to say and some things that are not appropriate to say. I think we've seen a lot of companies do that. But what Netflix did is exactly the opposite. What Netflix did is they said instead, we believe we have to talk about this. And we want to create an environment where everyone has the right to be a part of this conversation, regardless of whether you're black or white, what your background is, how you feel. The only way that we can really understand each other is if everyone feels safe to talk about it. And so they came up with a couple of principles that we know from experiments and from science and social science are very effective. One in particular is they told everyone at the beginning of each conversation, let's just acknowledge that this conversation is going to be awkward. And even more, let's acknowledge that I might say things the wrong way, and I'm going to ask you to forgive me. And you might say things the wrong way, and I promise you, I will forgive you. I won't hold it against you. I'll understand that this is happening in good faith. And studies tell us that that's really powerful, that when we acknowledge at the start of a conversation that mistakes might be made, that it's going to be a difficult conversation, it goes a long way towards moderating.
Is it not possible that then set up a template in which the Dave Chappelle controversy that came a couple of years later was able to flourish because everyone felt super empowered to share their feels?
Well, I think so. People feel empowered to share their feels regardless of whether they've been invited to do it or not, right?
Well,
they
could have done what some companies do, which is to say, there's a place for politics and religion. It's not in the office. Here, we're here to do a job. If you don't like it, there's the door.
But I don't think the feeling was that wouldn't work at Netflix, in part because it's an artistic company, right? They're making TV shows, and those TV shows have to be culturally relevant. And so talking about culture, talking about politics is part of their job. But the other part of it is that even when we do say that, it doesn't mean that people actually leave their politics at home. It doesn't mean that they don't bring their feelings and their emotions into the workplace. It just means that we repress them and they end up leaking out in often messy ways.
Hmm. I mean, the counterargument here, the reason why this is such an instructive example, I think, is that there's, regardless of whether or not there was racial inequality at Netflix or, you know, there was some systemic bias in the company, the attitude that I heard when that all went down from a lot of people on the other side of it was that this is censorious, this is hysterical, everybody understands that this word was not being used in a context that ought to be offensive. Therefore, we're sort of playing a word game where we're pretending to take umbrage at something that was not actually motivated by animus or hate. But your point is that that reasoned, rational approach gets you nowhere if it bumps into people's emotions?
It gets you nowhere if people don't agree, right? I mean, look, any type of controversy that we encounter, we can always say, well, look, you know, there's a way to minimize the controversy. There's a way to minimize the disagreement. Except that if I disagree with you and I feel strongly about it, when you tell me, let's minimize our disagreement, let's minimize our differences, it doesn't make me feel better. It makes me angrier, right? It feels like you're trying to control me, to not give me a voice in this dialogue. And so if everyone agrees that, oh, this isn't a big deal, then that's fine. But the problem with Netflix and with most tough conversations is that everyone doesn't agree it's not that big a deal.
Right.
In fact, there's some people who think it's a very big deal. And when the others say you're overreacting, it does not calm us down. It makes us more incensed.
What about the people who feel it's a very big deal to be allowed to use words as long as they're not motivated by hate? In the wake of that, those people were probably suppressed at Netflix.
Well, so I don't think anyone was actually suppressed. I mean, what's interesting about this case study is that, and again, I'm not an expert on what should be allowed in workplaces or what the rules
ought
to be.
No, sure, but it's an interesting thing to tease out for the psychology of it.
Yeah. And so what happened was that they basically created these forums where everyone can come to the table and everyone could say what they felt and what they thought. And it wasn't held against anyone, right? It wasn't, if you say something and it offends me, I'm not going to therefore say, look, you are offensive. I think you're a racist. Instead, I'm going to explain how your words make me feel.
Right.
And I'm going to try and have you understand me. But at the same time, I'm trying to understand you.
I guess I'm skeptical, Charles, that in the current, and we don't have to dwell on Netflix specifically, but I'm skeptical in the current social justice moment that when there are certain, I don't know, mob movements or highly orthodox mentalities that can gain a certain authority, that the dissenter still really has a place at that table that is valued as much as the people who subscribe to what is now the dogma.
I mean, are you a dissenter?
Well, I'm in favor of there being a maximal amount of dissent. So I'm curious about, you know, yeah, I mean, on that particular issue, my views have evolved over the past decade, right? Right, right. But but not everyone is, you know, is as privileged as me. If I'm a person who is, you know, suppose I'm a person of color who's working at Netflix who thinks that actually, you know, I have some fealty to linguistics and I don't really think that, you know, I think that people shouldn't be hounded out of a job for slipping up in that way. I wonder how liberated I would feel to say
Oh, pretty
that.
Liberated. I talked to people who said exactly that.
Really?
I mean, look, I understand that it's easy to paint this in caricatures, right? To say like, oh, well, there must have been a woke mob. Oh, there must have been people who felt like they had to bite down on their tongues. Except that the actual reporting doesn't bear that out. What we found is that when you create environments where people feel like they can bring their full self to work, they can say things without the fear of those things being held against them. You create an environment where people are proving that they're listening to each other and that we're having an exchange and that everyone belongs at the table. Everyone has a legitimate seat there. That what we find is that all these doomsday scenarios that you're talking about, the boogeymen, they tend not to show up.
I mean, I guess the difficulty...
Where the boogeymen do show up is when we do exactly the opposite.
Right.
I guess when we say some kinds of conversations aren't allowed.
Right, right.
Then suddenly people start...
I mean, the difficulty is in ensuring that we actually do create that environment of free expression versus paying lip service to it. And like the boogeyman, you know, to take the example of like I'm married to a guy, so a lot of people in my workplace would assume that I might subscribe to a certain orthodoxy about gay pride, for example. And I've had... You know, religious colleagues come up to me and say that in the whole take your whole self to work movement of the past decade, you know, it's become completely acceptable in most organizations in Australia for people to bring their whole self to work by a person wearing a dress or a person talking about their same-sex partner. But it's not that acceptable for a Christian conservative to bring their whole self to work by saying that they oppose gay marriage.
Well, are you just speculating or is there something specific you can point to?
Well, no, that's a specific conversation that I've had, for example, with, you know, Christian colleagues who have said that there's a rubric, there's a way of talking about talking, there's a way of talking about conversations which sounds highly inclusive, but actually is sort of just a way of enforcing a new dogma. So I'm wondering how we avoid the pitfall of replacing an old, in this case, homophobic dogma with a new homophilic dogma where, for example, the religious conservative doesn't have a seat at the table.
Well, so my guess is that if the religious conservative comes to the table and they say, I think you are evil and that you are living in sin with a man and you deserve to go to hell, that probably wouldn't be accepted
No.
or wouldn't be welcomed, right?
No, but they could go a lot shorter than that.
My guess is that if you're having an actual conversation, they're not actually saying that. What they're saying is they're saying, listen, you know, here's my perspective on marriage. I think that marriage should be I think marriage should be X and Y and Z, and my church tells me this and that. My guess is that if you actually have that dialogue, they are not trying to push you into a stereotype. They are not trying to say things that make them open to easy attack. Instead, they're explaining what they believe. Again, there's this always this like, I guess the thing that like I object to in the question. Is it presumes the most cartoonish or stereotypical way that this conversation would unfold. And I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, but I'm saying that those aren't conversations. That right. When we sit down and we actually want to understand someone, when we want to have a difficult conversation rather than just scream at each other or try and prove each other wrong, when we want to have a conversation, it usually doesn't come down to someone saying, you are evil, you deserve to go to hell.
No,
it usually comes down to them saying, here's what I think about the world, and then you sharing what you think about the world.
Okay, I'll park the sort of HR component of it for a moment, because it's not what's most interesting about your work, but I will just sort of note that you don't need to go anywhere near as far as saying that gay people are evil in order to nonetheless get in trouble with a human resources department if you are expressing a point of view that ran counter to what is regarded as being the social justice, the correct way of thinking about things in most organizations. I mean, you know, so this, I suppose.
So give me an example. Give me an actual example of something you've heard someone say that you think is not objectionable, but that has gotten them in trouble.
Well, it's a climate thing. So they don't say it because they feel they would be persecuted for it, right? But again, are you saying that they're paranoid?
You're falling back on like basically these generalities, right? These caricatures.
No, I'm saying there are specific.
Like, give me an example of something you have heard someone say that you don't think is objectionable.
Well, the point is that the thing is taboo. So they don't say it. The point is that if to give a specific example, it would be a conservative Christian or Muslim person in a progressive workplace who feels that to say we're talking about, you say we're producing a radio show and we're doing a lot of segments that are celebrating Pride, and they feel uneasy about promoting a vision of sexuality that's highly promiscuous and celebratory and pro-gay, they would feel uncomfortable, not just about saying that they think that it's evil, but about saying, like, personally, I'm not that crazy about being involved in something that involves like a lot of gay promiscuity. They feel that would put them on the outer, but maybe it wouldn't. I mean, maybe you're right, and they're paranoid.
You feel like you have a lot of colleagues who like are like talking about gay promiscuity on a regular basis, and this is,
well, how many do they have, like, to be to make the point?
But the point is that, like, what you're asking me is how do we ensure that people all get along with each other? That's, I have no idea, neither do you. But the point is that's not what I wrote about, and that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is there ways to have conversations that take advantage of what we know about social science that make them better?
So
and the answer is yes. Is it absolutely going to mean that every single person can say whatever they want and they'll never be punished for it? No, of course not. Humans are humans. But are there ways to structure those conversations so that they're healthier and easier to have, and that fewer people get offended or fewer people feel like they're misunderstood? Of course.
So let's talk about those ways. Because I think, I mean, one reason why I started with Netflix is I think it touches on something interesting, which is that people will sometimes hear a conversation as being about their identity or about who they are rather than taking it at face value. So, you know, the sort of less a provocative or toxic example of this is the married couple, where one of them says, you know, I'm feeling this way because, you know, some such and such happened at work. And the other person says, well, what you should do is go in tomorrow and you should tell your boss X, Y, Z. And the person says, I didn't want a solution, right? I just sort of wanted to be heard, in other words. So there are two different parallel conversations taking place. Each person has a different perspective about what's actually being trying to be communicated. How do you avoid that pitfall?
Well, so I think what's often happening there, and I think this happens, I mean, this happens in my marriage, this happens in every relationship, right? Where one person is expressing a feeling and another person tries to solve their feelings and it's not appreciated. What we know is that, and we're living through this golden age of understanding communication because of advances in neural imaging and because in data collection, we're learning a lot about what happens inside our brains when conversations occur. And one of the things that we've discovered is that we tend to think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about my day, or we're talking about Jimmy's grades, or we're talking about gay marriage. But actually, there's multiple different kinds of conversations occurring within this one discussion. And if you and I aren't having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, it's very hard for us to connect with each other, and it's very hard for us to hear each other. And in general, these conversations, they tend to fall into one of three buckets. There's these practical conversations where we're talking about making plans or solving problems. There's emotional conversations where, as you just put it, I tell you how I feel and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's social conversations about how we relate to each other and the social identities that we feel like are important to us. And in the example you just gave me, I think what's happening is one person is having an emotional conversation and the other person is having a practical conversation. And they're both legitimate conversations, but they're having different kinds of conversations at the same moment. And so it's hard to feel, connected. It's hard to actually listen to each other.
And are people Are people hardwired with particular biases towards one conversation or another? I mean, the cliche, the gender cliche would be that the woman comes home and talks about, you know, something that happened at work, with the subtext being that it's an emotional conversation, and the Mr. Fix-It would come in and mansplain to her, you know, what she needs to do about it. Is there truth in that hardwiring?
No. So there's actually been a lot of studies looking at this, because it is a widespread sort of pattern that people believe is true. And what researchers have found is that it's not accurate, that women and men both tend to speak more practically or more emotionally in equal measure. The difference is that oftentimes we remember very differently what someone has said. So when a man says something very practical, it stands out in our memory. And when a woman says something emotional, we tend to remember that emotionality. And it's this discrepancy in remembering that seems to skew our perspective on what the data actually says. Because when they just record people talking, what they find is that men and women are both equally emotional and equally practical.
So even if there isn't a gender split, is there some other split that doesn't cleave along gender, along sex lines, where some people are just more rational? Because I feel like I will tend to always reach for the more rational or practical solution to anything, which makes me a less emotionally sensitive person, for example, than my spouse, who will always have a more intuitive capacity to glean what the other person's emotional state is and to mirror that correctly.
Well, what often happens is that we develop communication habits that we fall back on. Right. And so if you're in the habit of presenting things in a very dry, very logical, very dispassionate way, that's a source of comfort for you. And so you'll do that. That does not necessarily mean that you are dry and dispassionate. Right. Let me ask you a question. When you are expressing something emotional to your spouse, when you're talking about how you feel, do you get super duper weepy or do you get kind of practical sounding?
Practical sounding.
Now, does that mean that you're exclusively practical?
No.
Or are you feeling something and you're in the habit of expressing it a certain way? But underneath, if we were to peel back the covers on that conversation, actually, this is an emotional conversation. It's just that you're more comfortable with a certain kind of phrasing and presentation.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
This is what we know, is we know that there are these cultural myths that some people are more emotional than other people, that some people are more rational than other people. And when we look at the evidence and we look at the science, it does not seem to be true. What does seem to be true is that oftentimes we inculcate men into talking in very rational ways. And so we teach them a habit that they fall back on. They feel a source of comfort there. And with women feel we inculcate them in ways of speaking more emotionally. And so they feel a greater familiarity, a greater comfort with doing so. But that doesn't mean the underlying conversations actually are different. It just means that how we've learned to express them is different.
Does it mean then that we need to pivot in the way that we communicate with someone who is acculturated in that way? Like, does the rationalist have to become more empathic and vice versa?
Well, I think it's helpful to do so. And I think that that sounds like a tall order, right? And so I think that there's an easy shortcut to it.
Just as long as it's only my spouse who has to change, Charles, right, I'm happy with your advice.
But here's an easy way, I think, to do it, which is if you ask more questions, then you tend to let the other person tell you what they're actually feeling or what they're thinking. And in fact, there's a certain kind of question, a deep question, that seems to be particularly good at this. And a deep question can sound kind of intimidating, but it's actually just something that asks about someone's values or beliefs or experiences that can be as simple as meeting someone and you know they're a doctor and saying to them, instead of where do you practice medicine, saying, oh, what made you decide to go to medical school, right? What's the best case you've ever worked on that you're like you're proudest of? Those are questions that allow someone to expose something more about themselves. And my guess is with you and your spouse, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, if you think this isn't right, My guess is that instead of trying to be more empathic yourself, or him trying to be more logical and rational, instead of doing something that feels artificial, that if you were to say to him, listen, I'm trying to understand more about how you're feeling. Tell me why this feeling that you're describing to me, tell me why it's so important to you. And if he was to say to you, listen, I see you getting practical. I see you getting kind of like logical about this. Tell me why being practical and logical right now, why it matters to you. What does it represent? What's important about that?
My question to him that you phrased would be reasonable. His question to me would just alienate me, because I'd say, of course I'm being practical, because how else are you going to sort out the world other than by sorting through it in a logical way? What, are we going to float away on a cloud and get our problem solved? But
you actually just told me a lot about how you see this, right? You told me that for you, a solution is more important than necessarily just an expression. And that's a really valuable insight to say, like, look, you're someone who finds something really important, not just in understanding, but in finding a way forward. And when I'm telling you about my feelings and I want you to understand my feelings, it means instead of just telling you I'm sad, I need to tell you why I'm sad. I need to tell you what I think I'm going to do to help talk to the sadness. It's really just about asking how the other person wants to communicate, what they're seeking in this discussion.
Right. Is there... Does authenticity come into this in any way, or is it just strategy?
Absolutely.
Because like,
No, it has to be authentic.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're, and it's a great question, because you're exactly right. I think that sometimes when we're talking about these different tools or tactics, it can sound like a training course for like manipulators, right?
Yeah.
That like if you just learn how to ask deep questions, and if you learn how to prove that you're listening, like then you can sell someone a used car.
Right.
But what's really interesting is that it does not tend to work unless it's authentic. So there was a really interesting study that was done where researchers created tape recordings of friends laughing together and strangers laughing together. And then they would play just 1 second of all the different tapes for listeners. And listeners with 90% accuracy could tell the friends from the strangers. Hmm. And the reason why is because we have this finely tuned thing in our head to detect inauthenticity. It's actually evolved with us as Homo sapiens, because in a state of nature, if someone's inauthentic with you, they're very dangerous. So we're almost predisposed to be suspicious of inauthenticity. And as a result, if somebody comes and they try and kind of manipulate you in a conversation, you might not say anything right away. But you know that that guy is a jerk.
Yeah,
right?
You can smell it. You can smell it a mile off. I mean, that's there's a risk that all of this talk sounds a little bit, if not manipulative, then a bit Oprah, right? A bit sort of like, you know, here are the three ways to make your partner feel like you're more empathic, or not just your partner. I mean, you talk about a CIA agent who was one of the best recruiters who can really bond with other people by finding common ground, by getting on their wavelength, by exposing himself to vulnerability and so on. And yet it reminds me of the old Groucho Marx line that, you know, authenticity is the most important thing. Once you can fake that, you've got it made.
You could do
it. Right? Like, what's the difference between being inauthentic and authentically deploying communication tools in order to achieve an end?
I mean, what I would say is that at some point, that inauthenticity is not, like, you're actually being authentic. If you're listening really, really closely to someone and you're repeating back what they're saying and you're showing that you're listening and you're asking them deep questions and you're trying to understand their emotions and you're expressing your own emotions, engaging what's known as reciprocal vulnerability, like you might be saying like, oh, this sucker, I'm pulling it over on him. But you're actually pulling it over on yourself. You have become authentic.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? So, like it's, you know, if you do something long enough and you fake it, it actually becomes true.
Yeah, that's true. And you also talk about these sort of brain studies where if you fake it long enough being on the same wavelength as another person, then you are literally actually sort of on the same wavelength. Like your brain patterns coincide. There are, you know, all kinds of physiological markers that will become consistent. You'll be mirroring each other's physical behavior and so on. Does that happen naturally, or is that a calculated process.
That absolutely happens naturally. That is how our brains have learned to communicate. Is that when I describe a feeling or an idea, you actually experience that feeling a little bit. You experience that idea. And as a result, our brains become more and more similar until we're in what's known as neural entrainment. We're aligned cognitively. And at that point, we can actually hear each other much more clearly. We can understand what the other person is trying to say. Now, you're exactly right that sometimes people try and fake this, right? But what happens is that if you do fake it, it tends not to work. And if you fake it well enough, then you actually become entrained. And so you describe a feeling to me and I experience that emotion. I might not want to, I might be doing it for ulterior ends, but we are connected and we are having an honest conversation.
There are some people who are just naturally good at this, right? I mean, there are people, you talk to people who've, you know, met Bill Clinton and they'll say like, you know, he shakes your hand and you feel like you're the only person in the room. You're the only person in the world. Like,
so what's interesting is that they aren't not necessarily naturally good at this. In fact, one of the things that we know is that most people who are super communicators, well, first of all, that anyone can be a super communicator. I thought going into this that there would be people who are charismatic or extroverts, but it turns out that what the data tells us and my experience tells us is that they come from all walks of life. And people like Bill Clinton is a good example. The people who end up being super communicators, it's often because at some point in their life, they were bad at communication or they had a real communication challenge. Sometimes people say things like, you know, I had trouble making friends in high school. And so I really had to study how to talk to other kids. Or in Bill Clinton's case, sometimes they say things like, my parents got divorced. It was a terrible divorce. I was the peacemaker between them. I had to really think about how I'm talking to my mom and my dad to keep them away from each other's throats. And it's that thinking about communication just half an inch deeper that oftentimes makes us much better at it.
Right.
That's what makes us a
super. But there must still be propensities and natural aptitudes, Charles, aren't there? I mean, what about neurodivergent people who find themselves, you know, who might be on the spectrum where, it's a real struggle for them to sort of what they regard as being to ape all of these kind of, you know, mammalian things that you have to do, eye contact, nodding along. You know, their instinct is just to ask the direct question and emotions be damned.
So folks who are significantly on the spectrum, yes, there is oftentimes a communication difficulty there, in part because they have trouble reading emotions on other people's faces and they have trouble conveying their own emotions. And that can be a stumbling block. That does not mean that they don't have as many emotional conversations or as many practical conversations. It means that it's harder for them to align. But beyond that, a situation where like someone is diagnosably neurodivergent, the data just doesn't say that there are some people who are born better communicators than others. In fact, what we know is that the people who think they're really good communicators, they oftentimes are not the best communicators, right? Because they aren't thinking about it. There was a study that was done in the CIA where they were trying to figure out who were the best communicators. And they found that the strongest prediction of who was good and who was bad is to ask people, how good are you at communication? And the people who said, I'm really good at communication, they weren't great. The people who said, you know, I struggle with it and I want to get better and I'm trying harder, they were usually super communicators.
Right. Why do you think that is?
I think because when we think we're good at something, we stop thinking about it. And it's that thinking about communication that makes us better at it. It also means that we feel this obligation. You know, one of the things that we know that super communicators do is that they ask more questions and they tend to match other people's emotions, but they also do things to try and signal that they want to connect with you. And it's that signaling that's often the most important thing that's telling you like, I want us to have a connection here. And we can do that through words. We can do that through language. 80% of the time when we laugh in a conversation, it's not in response to something funny. It's to show someone that we want to connect with them, that we like them. And when they laugh back, which is the most natural thing to do, they're saying, I want to connect back.
Yeah. I mean, another...
If I assume I'm a great communicator, I probably don't feel an obligation or a burden to signal to people that I want to connect
right.
with them. I just assume that we're connected,
yes.
whether we are or not.
And there may be an additional explanation for why people misdiagnose their own ability as communicators, which is that they misdiagnose what communication is and they mistake talking a lot for being a good communicator. I mean, I think I would hazard a guess that most people who think that they're good communicators are blabbermouths who steamroll over other people and think that that makes you a good communicator. Oh, I can't. You can't shut me up. I'm a great communicator. You know, right. Wrong definition.
I walk into every conversation and everyone else is silent. Yeah, exactly. I guess I convinced them all that I was right, which of course, what they're really thinking is, you are such a piece of work.
Yes, right. And do you notice in super communicators, I mean, one thing that I am mindful of is building a rapport before you get to the difficult stuff, right? So normally I would shoot the breeze with someone for at least half an hour before talking about something that has the potential to get their hackles up. Like if you take the first 10 minutes of our conversation, I did that wrong because I didn't know that the Netflix thing was going to go where it did, right? But it ordinarily, if I'd known that the Netflix thing was going to turn into some mild disagreement between us, I would have put that at the end. We would have done all this.
Yeah.
I would have started, then I would have raised the Netflix thing and not knowing that I was going to go into the kind of woke cancel culture angle. But you probably would have been more receptive and we wouldn't have had the mild friction that we had at the beginning. So does it matter what order you're doing things in?
So certainly getting aligned is really, really helpful before we have a difficult conversation. And by the way, I don't mind at all the fact that we're not aligned on the Netflix thing.
Sure.
I think it's interesting. Yeah. But I will say that oftentimes, so when we discuss it as shooting the breeze, sometimes we actually are kind of inadvertently disparaging what's actually going on, right? So our conversation in the last 10 minutes, I wouldn't say it's super casual. We're just shooting the breeze. We're not talking about the weather. We're actually talking about real meaningful things. But what we're doing is we're both trying to match each other. We're both listening to what the other person is saying. And you're saying, oh, here's something that Charles thinks is important, right? And I want to signal to him that I understand that he thinks it's important and comment on it. And I'm doing the same thing. Now, we're not talking about race and we're not talking about woke mobs. And so it's a little bit easier to get aligned on that. But it's the alignment that we're establishing at the beginning of a conversation that helps us navigate through those trickier parts. Mm. And oftentimes, you know, one of my favorite examples of this is that, you know, I think everyone's had this experience. You go into a meeting and you're sitting around waiting for the meeting to start. And you ask one of your colleagues, like, how was your weekend? And they say, oh, it was great. I went to go see my kid's graduation. And the easiest thing to do is to be like, oh, congratulations. That's really great. Okay, let's get down to business. But a much better thing to do, a thing that will help you align and only take a couple of minutes, is to say, oh man, that's amazing. Like, I imagine, like what were you thinking or feeling watching them walk across the stage? Like, was that a big deal for you? Now, that's a deep question, right? It doesn't appear a deep question. It doesn't appear overly intimate, but it's asking someone to talk about how they see the world and how they see their children. And when we do that, it can feel like shooting the breeze, but what we're actually doing is we're getting aligned in what kind of conversation we're having so that when we do get down to business and we start talking about where layoffs are going to happen, it's easier for us to do that.
Is there a cultural difference, do you notice, between different countries? I don't know how much experience you have living in other countries, but I mean, my sense is that if that happened to me, it wouldn't land in an Australian context the way that it would land in an American context, because Aussies are so much more allergic to phoniness than Americans are. And there's a certain politeness in America. There's a have a nice day culture where, you know, Aussies, you know, you ask them whether or not the best meal of their life was nice and an Aussie will say, oh yeah, it was all right. Whereas in America, it was awesome. You know, is there a difference?
So there definitely is different norms that establish the baseline. Right. So one of the things that we find is that I don't know much about Aussie culture, but in the UK, oftentimes there's a fear of discussing something that's too openly emotional. And so it's couched in other terms. Whereas in the US, and you know, it, particularly if you're on a talk show, sort of expressing things as emotional as possible is welcomed. Mm. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that Americans are more emotional than Londoners, but it does mean that there are norms around us and that we oftentimes base our behavior on the norms that we observe. And this is why those social conversations are so important. A good example of this is office gossip. So office gossip is actually an incredibly important part of how a company builds a culture. And the reason why is because it's a way for us to explain the norms or the standards or the mores to each other without having to be overt or overbearing about it. When we say like, oh, I can't believe Jim drank so much last night, he was like so inappropriate. What we're really saying is within this culture, it's not okay to get like sloppy drunk, right? Or if we say like, I can't believe Susie keeps hitting on the interns. What we're really saying is in this culture, that's not appropriate. Like there's certain standards that we hold ourselves to.
Right.
And the same thing can happen just in everyday conversation, that when I signal to you something about my personality and how I've learned to communicate, it's a way for you to understand the norms that I was established in. And sometimes we have to understand and acknowledge those norms in order to move forward. I, for instance, would disagree a little bit. I don't think Americans are more fake than Aussies. I don't think they're more comfortable with fakeness than Aussies. I think that sometimes what an American says that feels genuine to the American can come off to an Aussie as insincere. And that sometimes, and I will say this as an American, sometimes when Aussies say things that they mean as sincere, it comes off to me as not that way. But that's not because we're insincere. Any of us are more sincere or insincere than the other. It's because we've learned slightly different ways of expressing.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm not claiming that the nation of Australia is less fake, but does the Australian does the Australian temperament, or the maybe to a lesser degree, the British temperament, strike you as insincere or needlessly brusque?
I guess sometimes needlessly brusque, but I mean, that being said, like most of the Aussies I know, they really enjoy life.
Like we do. They're it's not, one of our downfalls.
They're not like getting in my face and being like, let me tell you all about your problems. Rather, no. They're like, where can we go have a beer?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's true. And so then that's a form of social bonding. And I suppose one could interpret it as being kind of phony camaraderie in some way. Yeah. There's a kind of she'll be right culture, you know, everything's chill, everything's cool, everything's yeah. off a duck's back, which I guess could land as equally phony to the have a nice day culture, just in a different direction. We're talking a lot, Charles, about the sort of feely conversations, but you talk in your book about there being three broad types of conversations, and conversations about how we feel, which are basically about how we feel, is only one of those types. The other ones being conversations about, well, who we are, which is sort of more the Netflix conversation, right? You know, when conversations yeah. bump up against tribal identities and actually start sort of, we can feel attacked on the basis of a subtext that may or may not have been intended. And then there's a conversation which is a what's this all about conversation. What's yeah. a what's this all about conversation?
So a what's this all about conversation is oftentimes us having a very practical conversation, trying to figure out what do we actually want out of this discussion, right? And we do this often at the beginning of each start of a conversation without even realizing it. It's often referred to as a quiet negotiation by psychologists within the discipline. So for instance, when we start this conversation and you ask me how I'm doing, one of the things that you're doing is you're inviting me to talk about kind of what's important to me at this particular moment. And that's a fairly like benign question. So you might not get to anything deeper. But if I say to you like, oh my gosh, do you like, you know, what's the best part of this podcast? Like what do you feel good about when you get across in a podcast? One of the things I'm asking you is a very practical question. Like I'm on your podcast. What are you hoping that I will provide and deliver that you think your listeners find is important? And that's oftentimes what happens in a conversation is at the start of it, we ask questions and we conduct experiments to see if the other person wants to play along, right? I might get informal and to see if you, or I might be casual to see if you get formal. I might interrupt you to see if interrupting each other is okay. And there's no one right answer, but during that, what's this really about conversation? What we're trying to figure out is, what does each of us want from this exchange?
So it's not an explicit what's this all about. We're not saying, can we just have a conversation about the dinner party next Thursday?
I mean, sometimes we are, right? You say to your spouse, like, look, we got to choose a menu. Let's choose a menu. Or we're here to talk about the budget for next quarter. Let's talk about the budget.
Yeah. And there's a framing. I mean, you know, sometimes the easiest way to broach something that is potentially hazardous in a conversation, suppose that you need to address something with your spouse, something that they did a couple of days ago that's been bugging you, rather than launching straight into it, is to create some kind of a framing device there where you give context to the conversation before the conversation even begins. And you say, listen, there's something I've been thinking about. Do you mind if I just offload it? I don't mean any offense, but can I just have the floor for a second? And can you listen to me in a spirit of generosity or something like that? Is that part of that toolkit?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's really powerful, right? Like, and the thing that I love about what you just said is that you asked permission. You said, look, there's this thing I need to talk to you about. It's been bugging me. Do you mind if I like take the floor for a moment? Do you mind if I bring this up? And what you're really doing is you're basically asking permission to have this kind of conversation in the way that you need to have it, that you want to have it. And you're giving the other person the ability to say what they want, right? They might say, absolutely, like, I'd love to hear. And then I would like to respond if you don't mind.
Yeah. What has texting and emailing, in particular texting, done to all this? Because I find myself vastly preferring texting people, because in the context of texting, it's not necessary to do those, to have those kind of preemptive, you know, I can't call somebody who I haven't spoken to in a couple of weeks and just launch into what I want to talk to them about. We have to do the niceties. We have to do the how are you going. Some people love that. They prefer the phone. They'd like to talk for 4 minutes about something before they get to the point. It would be rude and curt for me to just call somebody and say, hey, about this thing, and then start launching into it. It's not rude at the moment in culture to send a text that says, do you mind if I send over a document for you to have a look at, without saying, I hope you're doing well. Has your mum recovered yet? You know, is the dog doing all right? Isn't the weather nice? Is it changing?
Well, okay, so let me ask you a question. Yeah. If that document says, by the way, I think you're a jerk, here's all the things that are wrong with you, do you feel just as comfortable sending a text being like, hey, by the way, I'm going to send you right? No. So I think that we calibrate a little bit. And I think what's happening there is that we recognize that there's different rules for different forms of communication. And when we forget those rules, or we pretend those rules don't exist, that's when we get into trouble. So one of my favorite studies illustrating this is that about 100 years ago, when telephones first became popular, there were a bunch of studies that said, no one will ever be able to have a real conversation on the phone because you can't see each other. And now we would say that's ridiculous. But what's interesting is that at the time, those studies were right. The early transcripts of telephone conversations, people did not know how to talk to each other on the phone. They basically used them like telegrams, like they would send shopping lists or grocery lists or stock orders. Now, of course, by the time you were a teenager and I was a teenager, we could talk on the phone for like 7 hours a night, right? It was some of the most important conversations of our life. And it's because we learned what the rules for talking on the telephone are that are different from talking face to face. And when we're talking on the phone without realizing it, oftentimes we'll over-enunciate our words a little bit. We'll put more emotion into our voice because we know that the other person can't see our expressions.
Yeah.
Now, there's all these new forms of communication, right? We've been talking on phones for 100 years. We've been texting for like 20 years at most. And if you're in my case, more like 5 years, and slacking and using emojis. Like, I don't even understand what half of them mean. So
just beware of the eggplant emoji, Charles. Yes, that's not a good one.
My kids have told me exactly that.
Yeah.
But what's interesting there is that there are these different rules for different forms of communication. And if I take a second and remind myself that like texting is different from emailing, is different from calling someone, I know what to do. I know what form of communication is best. I know how to have that. But sometimes when we're so fast moving, or we just let ourselves get lazy, we forget and we pretend that these differences don't exist. And that's when we usually get into trouble.
In defense of the early people using the telephone, it probably cost about $150 a second in today's dollars. So their shopping lists were probably, what do you want to say? I need tomatoes. Okay, I'm going to get your tomatoes. Bye.
You're probably right.
But I wonder, you know, there's a lot of fretting and hand-wringing from a certain generation of people at the moment about kids these days who don't know how to look each other in the eye and who never talk to each other, you know, who have had their communication abilities deranged or impeded by constantly being on screens and consuming everything from TikTok and Instagram comments. Do you give any credence to that?
Well, what I would say is that having conversations and practicing conversations is really useful and important. Now, my kids have conversations.
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen, and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations with Substack.